Good morning. You're listening to KSQD, Santa Cruz, KSQT, Prunedale. It's Saturday morning, so this must be your Saturday morning garden show in the garden with myself, Stephen E. Pop, and
Joe Truscott.
Yay. And hey, folks, this is going to be an absolutely perfect day to be out in the garden.
Let's get a little sound check here. Dave, are you there? Can you hear us?
Well, good morning. Yes, I am.
There you are.
Hey, Dave.
All right. Well, listen, I want to introduce our guest today, Dave Bloom. For the past decade, Dave has his work has centered at his 14-acre organic farm, Whiskey Hill Farms and Science Center. It's a hub where he and his team design innovative and share resources, education, technology services, that acceleration, adaptation of regenerative agriculture practices. There is a mouthful for you. This is to bring elegant solutions to ecological problems on a global and community scale. Now, Dave, I've just said a mouthful. Why don't you tell us what that means?
Well, it means ask me a question about the problem you have, and I'll help you figure out how to fix it.
Cool.
That's the simple thing.
Dave has been at this place for the last 14 years, but he has an extensive history working in agriculture and other fields. He's also the author of a book called Alcohol Can Be a Gas, which is forwarded by none other than Buckminster Fuller. That was written some time ago, and I don't think we're talking about having fun with alcohol so much as using it as a fuel. Is that correct?
That's correct. There are many uses for alcohol, but, we all know it as a beverage, but alcohol is useful for many things, including making vinegar. Talking about the product you were talking about earlier, you start with alcohol and you use a bacteria which converts that into vinegar, and then, of course, the 19% vinegar is a bit more concentrated than nature would make it, but it makes a very effective herbicide.
Oh, I'm glad. See, I got support. I got support for something, and, you just feel hopeless.
Does this mean when my wine goes bad, I can use it on weeds?
You could probably use it, but the 19% one really gives packs a wallop. Hey, Dave?
Yeah. Well, the thing that I'm most impressed with, Dave, is that not only your background, and we'll get into a little history here in a moment, is the volume and diversity of not just plants and products that you have out at Whiskey Hill Farm, but all these other innovative things, whether it's making alcohol, biofuel, distillery, fish emulsion, all kinds of things. It's I think you told me over 150 different tropical fruits growing in sort of synergy together in the greenhouses, along with a large amount of turmeric and wasabi, which are fascinating plants in their own right. Am I missing anything there, Dave?
Oh, well, you're going to get a pretty rounded overview, but yeah, we have trialed many different things over time and taken things that people haven't done commercially and figured out ways of doing it that way so that they're not, niche items or things you can only get from another country imported here.
Sure.
We've done a lot of good work with that here at Whiskey Hill Farms, and some of the work around here has been done by people in the past. One of our favorite crops is Frederick passion fruit. That was actually developed at UC Santa Cruz.
Uh-huh.
And it's an amazingly wonderful plant, which has been underappreciated because other varieties of passion fruit, typically from South America, have been the ones that get sold here. But Frederick is really remarkable because it can take a few degrees of frost.
Mm-hmm.
Almost any other passion fruit, are going to be burned by that. So we're looking into being a commercial producer of Frederick passion fruit because its flavor is just wonderful.
That's good to hear, especially all those people who love making pavlova.
And for those listeners who are unfamiliar with the plant, this is the botanical is Passiflora edulis. It is a climbing vine, and there are, as Dave mentioned, a number of different species with different sized and different different colored fruits. The passion fruit that we're the most familiar with is a dark, dark purple, and tends to need to ripen a little bit to the point of almost being ugly before you use it. Kind of reminds me a bit of a medlar, but not quite that bad. Yeah, passion fruit, passion vine can be very, very frost sensitive. And Frederick is, that's new to me. I'm familiar with another cultivar called Nancy Garrison that was developed over the hill in the Santa Clara area from a farm advisor. But that is just one of the many things growing. But I wanted to jump back a little bit into your history, Dave. I understand that you grew up in San Francisco. And if I'm not correct, your family grew all of your own food, vegetables, in a garden in San Francisco. Is that correct?
Well, yes. My family was, we were relatively poor, you know, and my father grew up in the Santa Clara Valley. His family grew all their own food and also worked on other farms in the area, which back then, you know, there were an enormous number of farms where we now have Silicon Valley today. But we kids were out there all the time working in the backyard, and 80% of everything we ate came from the backyard. And the things we didn't do were animals, we didn't do grains, but everything else. We had 13 fruit trees back there that we had worked with. And so it was a great education. But, you know, our backyard wasn't quite big enough by itself to support my brother, sister, and my parents. So the old next-door neighbor, old fella from Germany, you know, he had a really big backyard too, but he was too old to be working it back there. So we went and talked to him and said, tell you what, you let us use your backyard, and you can eat all you want anytime you want, and we'll eat the rest. So we took over his yard. Well, you know, that was going so well, the neighbor on the other side
got in on the game. Yeah.
And so we had three yards going. So it's not like just my little backyard, you might say. It was a big backyard, actually.
What part of San Francisco was that?
It's a part you've never, ever heard of. It's called Silver Terrace. And, you know, when you look at a map of San Francisco, it's like kind of off to the side, like it's not really there. When I was growing up, where Highway 280 now comes into Highway 101.
Sure, know it well.
Well, when I was young, Highway 280 wasn't there.
Right.
And that was a creek that ran down that canyon.
Oh, boy.
And just about when you got to Highway 101, it would go underground into a culvert and out to the bay. So, where I lived was right up on the edge of the slope above Highway 280 to the south. And that's where we grew up. That wasn't the best climate of San Francisco because, you know, that notch there, the canyon where 280 is in there. Well, you know, when it would warm up over in the East Bay, well, the air would rise and then something had to take its place. So air from the ocean would come barreling down the canyon trying to head east. We had an awful lot of fog where I lived, and I can tell you as a kid, and thinking about, you know, the climate of my family little mini farm there, was I'd be sitting under a bank of fog looking out to the east and seeing the sunny East Bay hills you know, tantalizingly warm, but not where I was. It was plenty cold and windy. So it was great.
You must have had an ongoing growth pattern, right? You always knew what to grow when. It wasn't like, you know, back east in Ohio where, you know, here's the summer, here's where you grow, and that's it in the fall. So you must have had a pretty good idea of what to plant when.
Well, we learned over time, you know, at that time, the kind of resources we have today. We have the USDA planting guide, of course, but that's for regions. And when you look at or areas, but in San Francisco, with all its microclimate, it was up to observation and practice and learning, you know, year to year, what needed to go in. But that's the beauty of California is that we have, well, I got to tell you, as a farmer, you know, we say that we can harvest for 12 months in California and plant for 10. So, you know, it's, some of us who've been farming a long time think we should probably go back to the Midwest where you actually get a vacation because it's too cold to plant anything, you know.
Exactly. And the timing's got to be correct. You know, you can give and take a little bit. At least that's my observation here in California.
Oh, yeah.
But back there, man, you plant too soon, you could lose everything with a late frost.
Oh, and if you plant too late, all that stuff you were growing doesn't come to fruition.
You're describing the challenges of growing in the peninsula region and central coast of California. My property in Prunedale is that way. I can stare out to the east and see it's so bright and sunny, and I'm in the gloom of June quite often. But now, with your greenhouses and the volume of plants that you have going there, and you know, when I was there recently, it was very much like being in a tropical jungle setting where there were all sorts of canopy plants, understory plants, and even an overarching sort of a vine canopy covering most of the roof of the greenhouse, which it was a fascinating combination of plants that all seemed to be working together in harmony. And I guess that would be sort of the goal that you've talked about with biodiversity and biosystematics. Is that right?
Well, certainly. I'm learning from nature, you know, and applying the lessons. And so, you know, we have all these myths in gardening, right, mm-hmm. that are absolutely not true, but they're considered gospel.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And passed on from this generation to the next.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm threatening to write a book about the 50 untrue garden myths. You know?
Right.
But the really super untrue one is the one on every seed packet that says plant in full sun.
Yeah.
Everyone has seen that, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to plant it in full sun. So what that means, of course, if that was true, is if there was a overhanging branch in your garden and it shaded what you planted there, well, then it would die, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, because you didn't plant it in full sun. Well, you know, so the reality is we evolved as human beings, you know, at least those of us who survived, along the edges of forests primarily. Right. That was our prime habitat for survival, because if we were out in the tall grass away from the forest, there's lions out there. And so people who went out there, well, they got made lunch.
Mm-hmm.
If we went too deep into the forest, well, there were big cats in the trees that would drop on you, right? So the best place to be for a human being to dodge back and forth from predators back in the days before we settled in villages and stuff was the edge of the forest. The other thing about the edge of the forest is it's the most diverse plant community.
Mm-hmm.
It's got gradations going each direction from the edge of the forest in deeper in and more to the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So the diversity of food that was there is something that worked for us because we were omnivores. So sure. It was a good environment for us to be able to take advantage of. And it helped in some way favor those of us who would eat a diversity of foods, you know. We absolutely evolved in and around the plant communities that were the most diverse. And, you know, we're an animal that can eat a huge, you know, diversity of different kinds of fruits and vegetables and then, of course, meat. So,
if a lion's chasing you, you know,
I think
they're not very good at climbing trees. So up that tree you go, kids.
I always think it's better to eat than be eaten. I agree with you that it is a fact that the most activity, even for wildlife, is at the edge of a meadow on the forest and the edge going in. And the diversity seems to have the ability, the plants themselves have the ability to support one another. And this gets into something that I've worked a lot with in my consulting work and in my landscape work, is using plants in guilds, plants that support one another. And I know you've done some work with this, but what I was fascinated by is that you are not only creating guilds within your growing environments, but you are using plants from widely diverse areas and getting them to cooperate. That must have taken a lot of trial and error, no?
Well, yes. And trial and error is something all of us love to do in our garden. Mm-hmm. Some people might call it scientific research and curiosity.
As a professional grower in the past, exactly. I can tell you my failures, but I definitely believe that it takes at least three full years or three full growing cycles and seasons before you get to really know a plant. And at that point, you can start to have a conversation with it, it seems to me.
Yeah.
So to blend what we've been talking about together with what you've just asked me, mm-hmm. you know, let's look at, for instance, probably best known individual plant community that people have developed over time. And almost all of you out there, if you haven't heard of the Three Sisters, well, mm-hmm. we'll explain them now. So in Latin America, the big three foods that people could rely on were corn, beans, and squash. Those plants together can sustain you with nothing else. If you know, the beans, of course, have a goodly amount of protein in them, which, you know, more than your average plant. And they're all very resilient and use different parts of the spectrum of sunlight. So you've got the corn growing as a nice erect structure, and it provides a moderate amount of shade, you know, depending on how thick the corn is growing. Mm. And so that creates an environment where beans can germinate, and the scaffolding that the corn represents, the beans can wind around that and climb it. And in so doing, they partially shade all the leaves of the corn. And then below those two, of course, are the hard squash, you know, that are binding and underneath the deeper shade from the other two crops growing above.
Generally speaking, those type of squash plants that were planted in this Three Sisters of the Field combination, they weren't your summer squash like a zucchini or something. They were much more the winter squash, the gourds and the pumpkins and those sorts of things.
And there are a rainbow of varieties of those, what we call hard squashes, yeah, you know, instead of the soft summer ones.
Sure.
So imagine now the sunlight's falling on your edge of the forest, your forest of corn, beans, and squash, and as the sun shines down on it, the beans are shading the corn and the corn is shading the beans. They're sharing the sunlight there. Mm-hmm. And then they both filter the sunlight, so a much lesser amount reaches the floor of the forest, the ground underneath the corn and beans. And so the corn is really adapted to being way out in the sun. It has very narrow leaves, right? So it's a minimum amount of impact on the plant.
It's a grass.
Yes, it's a grass. And then the beans have bigger leaves because they're able to operate with a little bit more sunlight from the shade provided by the corn. And then the great big leaves are on the winter squash below, big solar collectors, so that they can take the dim light that's been filtered by the other two and make good use of it.
Sure. And additionally, that those large leaves of the squash will help to act as a living mulch in terms of shading the soil there, keeping it slightly cooler in the root zones.
Do you want to also talk about slash and burn? Because wasn't that part of the
Before we get to slash and burn, Joe, I want to remind everybody that be very careful about the squash that you choose to plant. I've done the Three Sisters of the Field thing, and one year I planted one of my favorite squashes, which is the fig leaf gourd, Cucurbita ficifolia, also known as chiacayote in the southern regions. And this is a squash vine that will eat your house. It will.
Yes.
It pulled my corn down. It smothered my beans, but I had huge, huge melons from this thing. They look like giant dinosaur eggs. Eggs, green and white speckled. But yeah, just be careful what you plant, what you choose. And I want to know, before we get off the topic, fact or myth, the beans, we know, as a legume, do fix nitrogen on their roots, but is that really available to the other plants?
Yes. Now, there's a couple of things here that we should, you know, you just spurred my memory about the big leaves, of course, and smothering. You know, the big leaves on the squash, actually, you can actually see solar saturation. In other words, when the plant has too much sun, well, in terms of corn and beans, you can't, like, visually see when they are stressed out. But you can when you're talking about winter squash. Hmm. when you look, if as the day moves on from the in the morning, the leaves are all nice and perky and open and up, and then all of a sudden around noon they start drooping and they look wilted. And you know, the first time I saw, you know, in my garden my whole patch of squash, you know, this was out in the open sun, wilting. Well, I immediately got the hose and went out and watered and watered and watered, because, you know, hey, now that we have to save the farm, right? And and then lo and behold, you know, that worked, and all the leaves perked back up, and you know, I tapped myself on the back for saving the farm. And then the next day, about noon, the same thing happened. Mm. And I knew the ground was wet enough. So what you're seeing there is solar saturation, where the plant actively deflects the sunlight so it does not get overwhelmed. So the plant intentionally droops its leaves so that it doesn't take the full impact of the sun, reducing the surface area. And so the middle of the day, all plants pretty much stop producing food while they are overwhelmed by noonday sun.
Mm-hmm.
So the way of having three plants together makes it possible to have more hours of productive sun a day, because they cross-shade each other. So, you know, where we can go from this is that you go up into bigger canopies. So now, you know, we have the simple corn, beans, and squash, but wait a minute. There's more room above it. So now you can have trees above these other crops that lightly shade the food underneath. And now all those crops can grow all day and not be stopped from 12 to 3 or 12 to 4 by being saturated by solar energy. So,
well, I think that what you've done there, Dave, is you've given a really good description of, you know, just what indeed a guild is. It consists of different plants. It doesn't have to be three. It can be many more. But each of those particular plants is going to be supportive of all the other plants in that environment. Now, before we're going to take a real short break here for about two and a half minutes, but I want to get back after the break. I want to talk about Joe's point about slash and burn.
Because Joe's sitting here pouting because he didn't get his thing.
Because I interrupted him. And we will also want to talk more about the really fascinating biodiversity that you have going on in your greenhouses, especially with regards insect control and such. But Dave, stay on the line. Don't go anywhere. We're going to play a little music and do a little business, and we will be right back. Stay tuned. And we are back. This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale. And we are coming to at 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM and streaming at KSQD.org, Community Radio for the Monterey Bay. We are here. This is In the Garden. We are here with our guest, David Bloom, from Whiskey Hill Farms and Science Center. So, Dave, what do you have to say about slash and burn?
We went from being hunter-gatherers, you know, with low population and just an abundance of everything for us to just pick and eat, to when we started being in bigger groups, and now we kind of had to get into the position of storing food through the winter and, you know, that kind of thing. And so we started doing more concentrated agriculture, you know, as a group now, not so much as individual hunter-gatherers. So that was, you know, really important, especially around grain, because grain can, you know, store through the winter. So it doesn't work so well to try to make that happen under the forest, you know. So what people did to clear a spot, you know, that was open and able to be growing a fast-growing crop like corn, was they'd burn down the brush and the small trees that were in an area, and all that wonderful ash that would be now covering the ground is like the distilled essence of all those plants, and it was a great fertilizer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And So then the crops that were going to be stored were grown. The squash can be eaten in the winter, so can the beans, and so can the corn. So this allowed us to, you know, be able to survive in climates that didn't have year-round of food, tropical fruit, let's say, if you were in the tropics. Mm-hmm. So it was a great adaptation, but you can only do it once every so often because, you know, you've now used up or all the nutrients you got from that forest ash. And so you move to the next patch and you do it there, and then the first one would regenerate.
Do you know if the Californian Indians practice this? I know it was done in the tropics and Central America, but was it ever part of the regime of California in Native Americans?
When I was back in college, I studied fire ecology with Doc Sweeney, who was the guy who really defined the whole field. California, having a Mediterranean climate, is a fascinating example of fire ecology. So this kind of thing is maybe where people learn to burn, you know, to do slash and burn. But in California, we routinely have fires in the summer, and we've been getting acutely aware of those since we now have houses in the way where those are.
Right.
We, in California, we look at certain plants and we say, oh my gosh, this one is like rare and endangered. And we saw some this year, but they're all gone and we haven't seen them again. Well, it turns out that all the plants that grow in California are adapted in one way or another to periodic fire. So there are whole species of plants that only come up in the second, third, fourth, or fifth year after a fire.
No kidding.
They come up, they reproduce, they scatter millions of seeds, and then they're gone. But the seeds are all there waiting someday for the next fire to come up and start the cycle all over again. So the seeds have inhibitors in them that can be removed by certain amount of sunlight with water, et cetera, other activators.
Sometimes even just smoke.
And you can look at things like redwoods, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, redwoods are absolutely dependent on fire to germinate. The seed won't germinate until it's been cracked by exposure to 180 degrees. Mm. Now, the way that worked for the redwoods, because all that dust that would fall from the trees would become sometimes feet thick underneath the trunks of the tree, and the seeds would all be caught up way off the ground in that mountainous dust.
Mm-hmm.
So when the fire would come through, it would burn the dust, crack the seeds, and Douglas fir the same way, mm-hmm. they could then germinate and grow.
Upon the next rain. Yeah.
On the next rain.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Humans have been evolving alongside fire for a long time, but in California, it was a fine art.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, I'm going to switch gears here again just a little bit. I want to get back into your greenhouses and the mass diversity of plant life that you have, but also you got quite a few critters happening there, and I'm going to have you talk about the frogs, but you also have catfish and crayfish, crawdads, and all kinds of things working in there. Tell us about that and how you're handling a pesticide-free environment for pest control.
Pesticides are one of the biggest problems in the world today. We use currently per year 1 billion pounds of pesticides a year in the United States.
Oh, yeah, Lord.
That's true.
Is that a lot? Oh, my God, it sure is. Because the amount of substance it takes to kill pests and affect our human endocrine system are vanishingly small. So.
Yeah.
This is an enormous amount of toxicity in our environment, and it's totally unnecessary. We just have to balance, you know, with nature to take care of our pest surpluses. See, I never think of things as bad or good. I think of them as surpluses or shortages. So when I first came to my property here, which was formerly a rose farm, there were just gazillions of bugs. It had been abandoned for about 3 or 4 years, they had been spraying with every possible insecticide.
And fungicide.
I can testify to that, having been a former rose grower, yes, yeah. In greenhouse.
Rodenticides, mildewicides, on and on and on. So you know, luckily those things do break down, you know, with soil biology, but it still left the pests that had withstood generation after generation.
Built resistance. Yeah,
super bugs. So I looked at that and I said, okay, I have a surplus of bugs. Boy, do I ever. So I thought about that. I said, I know how to put this surplus to use. So I went and put a camping lantern up in the rafters of my greenhouse and opened the doors on the greenhouse, and that light would shine outside. And as far as that light would shine, bugs would see it, and they'd fly toward the light.
Mm-hmm.
You're thinking, wait a minute, Dave, you have a surplus of bugs. And I said, no, I didn't think I had a big enough surplus of bugs. So I attracted the great outdoors of bugs into my greenhouse until there was a storm of bugs swirling around the light bulb. But, you know, there was a method to my madness, because something else comes to light, and that's frogs. Why do they come to light? Because frogs know that the bugs come to light. So in come all the frogs, you know, into my greenhouse. And these are our Pacific tree frogs. They're maybe 2 inches long, you know, and they come in. And when they get to where the lantern is, well, underneath the lantern would be a pond, a nice strip pond. It's made with pond liner, and it's a foot or two wide, and it's about 10 feet long, and, you know, it's got water in it, of course. And next to it was a pile of rock, you know, big, you know, like...
Like a gabion is what it looked like to me, a cluster of rocks.
They are gabion rocks,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so when the frogs would get there, they'd look at the water and go, wow, jacuzzi. And they'd look at the rocks and go, condominium, and they'd move in. So they hide in the rocks during the day because predators would love to eat them as tasty morsels. And but at night, they come out from the rocks and they hunt the bugs. Now, we know from grad students counting these at night that the frogs would eat 167 bugs a night on average.
What a fun job. Yeah. You
not
too. You
not
too,
166.
No. And you two boys and girls can stay up all night and count bugs, frogs eating bugs
and
in Dave's greenhouse.
And that's what
turns are for. Exactly.
You got it.
You want your degree?
Been there, done that. No degree to show, but been there,
hey,
done that.
But tell me the progression of building this. So you got the idea of bringing in the light, and then you saw frogs, and then you said, well, I want to keep these frogs here. So then you built the pond, and then you built... I mean, it was a progression of acts, right?
No. I'm an ecologist by training, so I basically designed, you know, for the purpose. So I knew what I wanted was the frogs, and I... You
and
know,
it
I
was going to happen, yeah.
By putting the lights up, that was going to bring them, but I also thought... Wow, you know, this is going to, you know, actually make for a better deal for the frogs if we have more bugs. So the frogs eat the thing about this is it's not a single effect. It's a system.
Uh-huh.
So the frogs come in, they reproduce, and then they go ahead and start eating the bugs. Now, how many bugs are there? What is the amount of bugs per acre? Well, it turns out that all across California, on average, 20 tons of bugs will move through every acre every year. Because bugs don't stay still. They are on the move.
Uh-huh.
So 20 tons of bugs. Well, to visualize that, imagine 20 cars parked in front of your house, and that would be the weight of the bugs that come through your 1 acre.
Hmm.
That's a lot of slow-moving meat.
Uh-huh.
So the frogs eat that meat, and they do it all over the greenhouse, you know, wherever the bugs are, and they eat them, poop them out, and give me a very nice, even spread of manure over an entire acre. Uh-huh. So here I've got the frogs taking care of the bugs, and they're also out there fertilizing my crops. So I don't even have to make compost and spread it if I don't want to, because they're carpet bombing the whole garden with fertilizer.
Now, you had the bugs counted. Have you ever counted the frogs per greenhouse?
Well, I can't say that on the air because there's expletives in it, but many tons of them. We never counted the frogs, but it's in the hundreds of thousands. Yeah.
And now, since doing that, how are the insect populations today?
Oh, well, the thing is, during my farm tours, I would I'd hold up a $100 bill, and I'd say to all the kids in the thing, I'd say, okay, kids, go off into the rows here, and if you can find a leaf with a hole in it, I'll give you this $100 bill.
Wow.
You have 30 seconds.
Wow.
Go. And you'd see all the kids, and even the adults, would start running into the rows, and all of a sudden, about 20 seconds into it, you see them all stand up with this, like, blank stare, because they're all realizing that they are not seeing a single bug hole at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a testimony to when ecology is in balance, it takes care of what we design it to do.
Yeah, you see, if I ever tried to do that, I'd have the wiseacre kid who took a pencil and poked a hole through the leaf and brought it back to me. But anyway.
That's right. Mr. Pop, there's one.
Here's one. Give me my
I want to talk a little bit about the frogs, though, because are they on a cycle, a seasonal cycle as well, where all of a sudden, hey, it's mating season, let's make babies, and they lay their eggs in the pond that you created? Is that what happens?
Yes, and that's going on right now. At night here, you practically have to have earmuffs on to go in the greenhouse because it is so beautifully, wonderfully loud, with, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of frogs singing. And our Pacific tree frogs are often called chorus frogs.
Because
of the wave after wave of singing that they produce.
Now, with the abundance of frogs in the greenhouse, have you seen snakes arrive?
Yes, the rock piles have two other predators that we like. One of course, is lizards.
Mm-hmm.
Lizards are the day crew. The frogs are the night crew.
Uh-huh.
The day crew. I love it, yeah.
The lizards eat 60 to 70 bugs a day each. And then, of course, the gopher snakes, our favorite snake, live in the bigger rock piles. And we almost never see any rattlesnakes. But the gopher snakes, they do what their name implies. So they take care of the gophers, which can be a really big problem in greenhouses.
Oh, and everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, because the aerial predators, the hawks, you know, et cetera, can't, and owls are actually the biggest gopher predator.
Yeah.
You know, you can imagine the little gopher thinking, I can see in the dark.
And
you
flying
can't.
Cat, yes.
Yeah, he sticks his head up and looks around and goes, yeah, you can't see me. But the owl can. The owl just drops, grabs the gopher by the head, and yanks him right out of the hole. So when you don't have the owls doing the work, something else does, and that's why the rock piles are also sized so that our gopher snakes can live in them, and then they patrol and take out all the gophers in the greenhouses.
Are they nocturnal, the gopher snakes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they come out at night.
Yeah.
So, Dave, we're kind of running down the clock here, and there is so much more that I had hoped to be able to talk about. So clearly, we're going to have you back, because we haven't even really touched on one of my favorite chemical topics, C2H5O4, aka ethyl alcohol. Whiskey Hill Farms.
371 Alabasas Road.
And
that's in Watsonville.
And I know, too, that, Dave, because of some traumatic injury to your turmeric crop a couple of years back and some other issues, you have been looking for investors and potentially even a buyer in the farm. Is that still an active search?
Well, yes. The thing, you know, I've been advising farmers for years and thinking, you know, they all think that I'm never going to have trouble. Dave Bloom's God, he's not going to ever get into a pickle.
It's farming.
Yeah, God, it's farming. Blood. And, you know, one good crop failure can be all it takes, you know. And so we are in some real trouble here. So, yeah, you know, we're trying to farm our way out of it. But, you know, what we really need, actually, because we haven't recovered from the loss of our $1.5 million turmeric crop, which was going to pay the note off on the farm. Mm. What we're looking for now are people to take over the loans so that we can go ahead and put the farm into a land trust so that is permanently protected and not subject to future speculators buying the land to build houses and that kind of thing.
I certainly hope that does work out for you, Dave. And I want to let all of our listeners know, if you want to find out more, Dave has a fantastic website. It's the Whiskey Hill Farm and Science Center.com. Yeah, check that out. And if there's a tour or something coming up, that should be posted there, I believe. And and Dave, we're going to have you back because we've got a lot more to talk about in the future here.
I want to hear about the turmeric.
I'll tell you some about that because I grew some of that turmeric.
Okay. Dave, thank you so much. It's been really, really a good show. And please come back.
Terrific having you on. Thank you, Dave. We'll be talking.
Always happy to.
Take care. Have a wonderful week. And until next week, happy gardening.